Can you tell us a little bit about the history and the implications of the Hunting Act?
Well, the history stretches back to the turn of the century when there was the first sort of vocal opposition to hunting. And it's no coincidence that some of the people who were opposed to hunting were also opposed to slavery and also were campaigning for women's suffrage, the right to vote, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Generally, the actual direct campaigning for a ban on hunting started in the mid-1920s with the formation of the League Against Cruel Sports, many of whose members were involved in some of these human rights issues as well. There were a number of private members' bills to attempt to ban hunting, always thwarted either by the party in power when it was the Conservative Party or by the House of Lords, because people in the House of Lords do have an interest in hunting. In the 1960s, the Hunt Saboteurs Association was formed, direct action started to take place, which meant more people were actually going out into the fields and finding out what was going on directly. They were no longer relying on reports that couldn't be substantiated. They were witnessing it with their own eyes. And then as we sort of moved into the 1970s, 1980s, up to the present day, better and cheaper photographic equipment and then video equipment was made available, which meant we could gather evidence, we could show exactly what was taking place and then put that in the public eye. And of course, because we as direct action activists were in the field, journalists started coming out with us and they were gathering a picture of what was taking place and that was being published. So the people of this country started to be able to put together a very informed opinion about what was going on. And I think that certainly helped gather the momentum towards getting a ban. In more recent years, in 1992, there was a Wild Animals Protection of Wild Animals Act. And unfortunately, the powers that be in Parliament at the time came under influence from the British Field Sports Society and the hunting lobby. Cruelty to animals, wild animals, was exempt in the case of hunting. That was something that was written into that legislation. There was another attempt by Michael Foster to bring in a private member's bill, and that was thwarted again, and the House of Lords certainly got in the way of that. Then in 1997, when the Labour government was actually elected on a manifesto pledge to allow a free vote on hunting, we entered into the phase whereby we had several attempts to put legislation through the Houses of Parliament on a free vote basis. And eventually, after a number of years, and the House of Lords actually being defeated by the Parliament Act, being overruled, we ended up with the Hunting Act on the statute books. And that gets us to the present day.
Yeah. How are you finding the adaptation from a preventative direct action role to the monitoring role or enforcement role that you're in now?
Well, it's a learning curve, certainly. It's not so clear cut. Before the ban came in, it was very clear they were hunting and we were going to stop them, and we knew exactly what we were doing. Now we're kind of in this no man's land, almost in limbo, where sometimes we're not sure whether or not they're hunting. So we have to observe them first to find out what they're doing. And then if we think they're engaged in illegal hunting, we have to make a choice. Are we going to try and gather the best evidence possible and then perhaps take some sort of preventative measure to intervene? Or is it a case that the terrain they're on means that we're not going to get any evidence, for instance, if it's a very thick forest or something like that, are we actually unlikely to gather any footage of that nature? Then we have the other situation, which is where potentially we have to just keep tabs on the hunt throughout the day, because they fall into the bracket of people who are acting under the pretense of following a trail.
Yeah.
And whilst we're there, they will stick to it. But as soon as we leave, if a fox pops up in front of them, they'll be chasing it.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, we're having to turn up and literally sometimes just be there.
So you're doing the both jobs, so you're still maintaining the old job before the Act?
Certainly, yeah. Although one interesting difference is that whereas before the Act, video cameras were quite often used to document activities in the field, sometimes to gather evidence of law breaking by hunt people, for instance, public order incidents when an attack people. and generally is a sort of protective tool to stop people attacking us in the field. Now, quite often, turning up and poking a video camera at them is enough to make them behave themselves. So rather than carrying around a whip and a spray and a horn and running across fields, we're turning up at the side of the road, pointing a video camera at them. Job done.
Yeah.
What an easy tactic.
Aye.
It's brilliant. It's, in some ways, it's made our life easier, but in other ways, where it's not clear whether or not they are hunting, it has made things more difficult.
Yeah. In terms of the old model of more direct action, and that was a more empowering type of tactic, how do you feel about that, the role of direct action? How important was that? And what effect is the non-direct nature of the new role as a monitor having on the hunt saboteurs society?
Certainly the role of direct action cannot be underestimated. If it wasn't for direct action activists, most of the footage that was taken of hunting, which showed how cruel it was, would not have been gathered. And also there wouldn't have been so much media focus on it. It would have been something hidden, happening away in fields, away from where people live. You know, it's something you had to actually go and actively search out. Obviously, direct action activists being present there brought a media focus onto it. You know, journalists could come and visit a hunt with direct action activists, find out what goes on, report back to the media. Everybody in the country then finds out, rather than it just being the few people who happen to live in the area where it takes place. So direct action definitely was vital to actually keeping the issue alive and ensuring that the focus on it was actually reflecting what really went on.
Yeah.
And there's also the fact that as direct action activists, we saved hundreds of thousands of lives, which matters to us very much so. And yes, you're right, very empowering. You know, a case of if somebody tells you that your only option is to try and vote in a party who will ban hunting, which used to generally be the response we'd get when we would talk to people about what their activity was and why it was so cruel. You know, we were given a more direct means. There's an irony in the fact that we used to be told, well, why don't you elect somebody who will ban hunting? Because as soon as we did, we were told that this was unjust and unfair and how dare you? You know, right. So we did what they said. We voted in somebody who banned hunting and then they didn't like that either.
Yeah. Okay, so with regard to the enforcement of the ban, what role do you think that if you compare and contrast the actions of the hunt saboteurs in enforcing the ban with the action of the law enforcement agencies, how effective do you feel each of those two groups are in enforcing it?
Law enforcement with regards to this ban has sadly been lacking. Mm-hmm. I think it's probably the only word I could use. There's been a tokenistic attendance at the odd hunt here and there by law enforcement officers, but it's been one or two and then it turned up at the start of the day and being told nothing bad's happening and left.
Jolly good.
Yes, yeah, that's all fine, we don't mind. It's interesting that locally in Hampshire, we used to attend the Hampshire hunt and there could be somewhere between 12 and 20 officers present prior to the ban whose activities all day long were focused on what we were doing. In fact, we did have incidences where hunt saboteurs were assaulted by officers, they were pushed around by them on public rights of way.
Yeah.
You know, let alone any legislation that was used to prevent us from, you know, leaving rights of way to try and intervene. And since the ban came in, there have been no police officers present at that hunt. And perhaps a mere coincidence, that particular hunter has now started engaging in more violent activity against protesters and saboteurs and monitors who are present.
Yeah.
There are no police there to enforce that. And when those police have been called and asked to intervene, they haven't turned up.
Yeah.
Now, when it comes to the actual enforcement of the Act, certainly I have not seen any active evidence gathering by police officers.
Yeah.
I'm not aware of any.
Whereas there would have been a proactive intelligence based assault on the hunt saboteurs prior to the ban, that's certainly not happening.
Certainly. Yeah. I mean, there have been situations in the past where police leave was cancelled in areas, they had helicopters in the air, they had roadblocks in place, they had briefings in the morning, you know, specifically to make sure the hunt saboteurs couldn't attend a particular hunt.
Yeah.
And now we've had situations since where hunt saboteurs have been present at the hunt. The hunt's been hunting illegally. When we tried to gather the evidence, we've then been attacked. and the police haven't even been able to send one car into the area at the time to apprehend the people involved in the assaults. Mm-hmm. And this is assaults where we've actually had video evidence taking place.
So what can people do if they're interested in Hunt's Island?
There was a number of different levels at which they can be involved. One is directly in the field. They can come out as frequently as they're able to, and actually get involved directly in either gathering evidence or intervening where necessary. There's another level at which people can be supporting members. They can do some fundraising for us, perhaps, try and help us buy those all-important video cameras and, you know, keep vehicles on the road to make sure the activists are out in the fields where they're needed. And then there's a third involvement that people can have, which is perhaps not revealing their true feelings and picking up information from people who are involved in hunting and passing it on to us. Because we can build up a catalogue of incidents, even if there's no direct evidence, we can at least sort of build up a picture of what's going on, when it's happening, where it's happening, and then perhaps get in touch with other organisations who can carry out covert monitoring, you know, to gather the evidence that's required. And then there's also a sort of fourth level, which is countering claims by Hunt's people that this is an issue about prejudice, you know, which certainly isn't, because it's the opposite. It's not about who people are, it's about what they're doing. Or about human rights, because as far as we're concerned, there is no human right to commit cruelty to animals. So that's something other that people can do, is when they see letters in the press from these poor beleaguered huntsmen, you know, whinging away about how their life has become so sad, you know, it's to sort of remind people that this is an issue about animal cruelty. And if anybody wants to get in touch with us, we have a website. It's www.sabs.org.uk. And they can contact us through the website and pass on information, come out and be active in the field, you know, or find out where to send the donations to, you know. So that's pretty much how people can get involved. It, you know, we're open to anybody, really.
Okay, well, thanks for your time.
Thank you.